So we're going to bring the meeting to order and get started with their business on the evening. And so I am here in the chair position tonight because I am covering for Adrienne. Vice chair, and she was not able to attend tonight, otherwise she would be here. But so I'm going to be going through the agenda with you all, and hopefully I won't miss anything. If I do drop down, I'll bring you something in the line. But anyway, welcome everyone, and thank you for being here. It feels really different to me when we don't have a meeting every month. It seems like it's been a long time since we all saw each other. But I do have some really wonderful news to share and an opportunity to share with all of you that we were able to have already with us a replacement for the position that Chief Bob Richardson held with us for a very long time. I think from almost the beginning, if not the beginning. And so I am very pleased to introduce Chief John Brooks, who is from the Richfield Police Department. And he was nominated by the Law Enforcement Council to succeed Bob. So I'm introducing today John Brooks. And John, if you feel comfortable, could you tell us a little bit about what interested you in participating in this council? Or anything else about your family you'd like to share, and then we'll go around and do a very brief introduction on the rest of us as well.
Absolutely. So my name is John Brooks. I am with the Richfield Police Department. I've been with Richfield for 3 years now, a little over 3 years. Before that, I did 26 years with Portland Police. So I'm right about 30 years in law enforcement. I was talking with Bob as he announced his retirement and at the Law Enforcement Council, and we were deciding what roles that he was fulfilling that kind of needed to be divvied up. And I volunteered to take the Public Health Advisory Council, and said it's a really great group with great people. And I said, well, that sounds like my kind of group. So, and then he said to me, and there's dinner. And I'm like, sold. So I'm really excited to be here and hope that I'm going to add some value to the discussions.
I'm sure you will. Thank you very much. And welcome to our group. And Joan, if we might start with you and go around and just name and what role you serve and anything else that you think.
Okay. Hi, I'm Joan Haley. I'm a community health nurse and I teach nursing, but I serve on this council as an unelected representative of the city of Vancouver.
My name is Travis. I'm with Clark County Public Health. You will probably not see me again. But I'm with the Celebration Program.
Jan Scott, I'm the Environmental Health Director.
Karun Nursi, and I'm representing medical doctors in Clark County.
Remy Eusen, retired, representing the Dental Society here in Jim.
Alan Mellick, I'm the Public Health Director, Health Officer.
Marla Sanger, and I came on this council as a representative for Peace Health. And then I retired from there, and I was able to apply for an opportunity to be a consumer of public health services. So that's my role now.
I'm Roxanne Wolfen, Community Health Director for Public Health.
David Hudson, Clark County Public Health.
Hi, John. I'm Lawrence, and I represent Peace Health.
I'm Doreen Gunderson, and I'm the Executive Administrative Assistant, so you all get your emails from me, and Clark County Public Health.
I'm Michael Kubler, the Director of Investigation and Response here at Public Health.
I'm Adiba Ali. I'm one of the epidemiologists at the Public Health Department.
And I'm Haley Pincus, and I work with our epidemiologist and do evaluation here with the Health Department.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Helder, and I'm another epidemiologist with Clark County Public Health.
Leanne O'Neill, I'm with the AmeriGroup, and I'm just here to learn.
I'm Shonda Hall Walker. I work at Clark College, and I'm here to learn.
Hello, I'm Cassandra Sellers-Reck, and in life, I am a trauma nurse and work at Legacy Emanuel Neuro Trauma ICU as a primary ECMO specialist. And for this purpose tonight, I am a tribal council member from the Calais Indian Tribe. I'm their health board chair and their youth board chair. And I am your federally recognized tribal member.
Young Rock, our club utilities of water providers.
Mark Collier, representing septic installers, designers, and maintenance people.
Paul Childress, I represent the restaurant of Clark County.
I'm Katie Wynn, and I'm your youth representative.
I'm Stephanie Boisimasha, and I'm a nurse practicing in Clark County.
I'm Sandy Brown, and I represent the consumer department.
I'm Charlie McGordon, the principal of Bathurst High School and the parent of the educational community.
And we do have a couple of visitors from the community, but my understanding is that they're not needing to have time to speak to this group. Is that correct? Great. Thank you for being here, though. Appreciate your presence. Okay. So we'll get on with our fact business. So first thing that we need to do is to approve our minutes from the last meeting on December 10th. So hopefully you have a chance to look at those, and I'll just assume that we have, and call for a motion to approve the minutes from our December meeting.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded, and we'll call for a vote. All in favor of approving the minutes from December, please say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thank you. Right. The executive committee, I'm going to turn this part over to Dr. Melnick because it's going to involve some change in our executive members. And so I'll maybe let you take it from here.
So as the ex officio member of FAC, I will facilitate this part of the meeting. So first of all, I want to thank the nominating committee, Joan Cayley, Remy Eusen, and Adrian Fairbanks. Adrian's not with us tonight, for their work on providing this outstanding slate of officers. And I think unless anybody has any objections, we're going to have folks vote on the entire slate of officers, and these folks will be on the executive committee. So the slate is, and I'm going to ask them to step out while they do the vote, so in case, I doubt that folks will vote no or anything like that, but if people will be, feel free to vote their conscience and not worry about how, it seems like less of a conflict and more ethically responsible to have the folks who are being voted on by their peers to be outside the room. So I've already said too much already, but anyway, the slate, the nominee for chair is Marla Sanger. The nominee for vice chair is Aru Andurdi. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. And the member at large is Sandy Brown. So we'll ask the three of them. Yes.
I have a process question. Yes. Why do they have to leave the room if they are nominated from the people sitting here? I'm not sure what standard you use. Is it Robert's Rules of Order or what process you have in your bylaws?
Yeah, they're nominated by the nominating committee, so they're not nominated by the entire council. They're nominated by the nominating committee, so the entire council hasn't had input. Based on the boards that have been in the past, for example, I'm on the Peace Health Board. That's a standard that we use, and I think it just makes it more comfortable for everybody involved to not have to see whether their peers voting for them or not. I don't know that I can attribute it to any particular Roberts rules or anything like that. But every board I've been on until now, this is basically how it's been done.
This is an unfamiliar process for me, so I would like to hear from the people that I'm going to vote for. Do they speak?
Excuse me, do you want them to make a statement?
Yeah, do they do that? How do we know to vote for them?
I think that's what the nominating committee, we pulled, if we go back to the meeting in the fall, what we've done is as the nominating committee has established just a couple meetings ago, we seek out all from the entire group anybody that would like to serve. And there are emails that are sent out, and we talk about it at the meeting, and then based on that input, we meet and Most of the time, the people, we've always, I mean, I've been on the council from its inception, we've always just had a single slate. We have not had a lot of, we've never had any contested races for the slate of officers. And some of that is, you know, we've been very open in terms of soliciting people's interest. And if people are interested in, you know, we've had young people that really have never held a role before. That person followed me when I was that was our first chair, and I followed him. So, but that's the process that we've used. And so the nominating committee, Remy and Adrian and I, talked about these people and then put them in this order and recommended it to the executive committee.
Weren't their names released? There's been time for people to vet them because we're not voting on their name. The slate didn't come up today.
Uh-huh.
The slate has been out there for 2 months. I believe it was released in December. So folks had a chance to ask questions. I think the folks on the council, the three people who are on the slate are well known to council members from participating with them at meetings over the year. Their names have been out there for 2 months, and nobody else has nominated themselves or suggested anybody else, but it's been out there. And I think the folks here on the council know the three members the three people on the slate.
That's why we presented the slate at the December meeting.
Yeah, it's been 2 months, it's been out there. Okay, so unless there's any other objection, do folks, I mean, you're the council, if you all want to object to this process, do I hear any? Okay.
I think there could be improvement. Maybe we talk about that afterwards.
You know, there can always be improvement, so if the council wants to discuss that, I'm an ex officio member, so if the council wants to discuss it, you guys can discuss it. The nominating committee, we asked for volunteers for the nominating committee. We had a few volunteers. They're the ones who stepped forward. They solicited and talked about folks who were interested in serving, willing to serve, and put those names out there 2 months ago. I personally think any process can be approved, but from the boards I've been on and the processes I've seen, this one is pretty good, but I'm sure there's room for improvement everywhere.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever had an election where two people were running for the same position.
Right. Right.
It was hard enough when I was on the committee mm-hmm. to get people.
So yeah, it's a responsibility of a lot of extra time.
It's also, each year, there have been very few volunteers to serve on the nominating committee as well. So, you know, in terms of the improvement, I think that this next year when we have a nominating committee, it'll be a perfect opportunity to come forward and serve on the nominating committee and maybe really help us address the process, see if there's areas for improvement.
Okay, so let's, this shouldn't take a whole lot of time. So.
We're not going to do that.
So what I will need is a motion to approve the slate.
From the nominating committee, I bring this to the Public Health Advisory Council, and I make a motion that we that we vote for the cast a unanimous ballot for the slate of officers as proposed.
Any second?
Second.
Is there any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
I'm going to abstain because if I don't get to hear about the people and who they are and have a bio, I don't have intimate knowledge. And when I'm voting for something, like, I need to know. I appreciate the committee might have vetted it, but for myself, I like to know, so I'll abstain.
Okay, that's fine. I think.
Yep, we're ready.
Okay, passes.
I don't see why anybody has to leave.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah.
So the slate was approved, and I think at the next meeting, is that Roxanne Brackenbaum, that the new officers will be in their positions. Congratulations. Thank you all for coming. Yeah.
Well, thank you, everyone, for taking a moment to take care of that. The next thing that we're going to hear about will be coming from Dr. Melnick and Roxanne, and this is about that the Washington State Board of Health, which is a pretty important body to the residents of the state of Washington, because that's where policy is set, that's where ideas are generated, and you know, it's just a really incredible group, and has really hard work to do. It works closely with the county to make sure that we can provide the best public health for our citizens possible. And it happens that the Board of Health is looking for people interested in serving on board. So if I can ask you and to give us more information about what they're working
for. I'll go ahead and do it. So the Board of Health is selected, appointed by the governor. And actually, in addition to analyzing policies and providing input on public health issues, they actually write the WACs. So they write the Washington Administrative Code. And that has the force of law. So the WACs are the way the statutes are interpreted. So if you think of the RCWs, the Revised Code of Washington, as a law, the WACs define how that law is actually implemented. And when the WACs are written, they have to be public hearings. So the Board of Health has to have public hearings. So that's a pretty heady responsibility for the Board of Health. I'm trying to remember, just recently they had those hearings, and I'm trying to remember what the issue was, where they had hundreds of people present that wanted to testify. So, well, I think was it the vaping? So it might have been the flavor ban. Yeah. Anyway, might have been the emergency rules. I can't remember, but I don't think it had anything to do with vaccinations. But they have an opening for a. So there's different positions on the Board of Health, and they have an opening for a consumer. And they don't, right now, the Board of Health doesn't have any consumers from Southwest Washington or this part of the state. So it'd be great if we could have somebody. It could be a FAC member, but it could also be, if any of you folks know somebody you think would be a really good Board of Health member, you can suggest their names, and we can, if they're interested in applying, they have to go through the process. We would forward their name up to the governor for, you know, potential appointment. It is a pretty big responsibility. So because it's the State Board of Health, they're based in Olympia. They have meetings 7 to 8 times a year. 2 or 3 of those meetings occur in other parts of the state because they do try to get out to other parts of the state. But that's even more travel unless it's here. Most meetings fall on the second Wednesday of the month. Travel, lodging is all paid for, your board member, and there's also, some members qualify for a $50 a day stipend, and the term is 3 years, so it's a 3-year term. So if you know anybody you're interested, any of you are interested, I think any of you would think great board members, we will forward the link to the application to those people. We will forward the link to the website where they can apply for the Board of Health position for anybody who's interested. I needed to say anything else, but feel free to send your names. If you want to send recommendations to Doreen, Doreen can make sure that the people you're recommending, including yourselves, if any of you are interested, get the link to the application.
So the next item on our agenda is it's going to be a great presentation and discussion. David Hudson will lead off, and we're going to hear about the Community Priorities Project.
Great, thanks. Thanks for including us on your agenda tonight. Some of you may remember that I came last year and gave you kind of an introduction to the Community Priorities Project. We were just starting to plan for the project. And I'm pleased to say, because of the good work of my team, team that I work with, we actually have something to show you tonight. So I'm going to give an overview of our health assessment and evaluation team, just explain the role that they play within public health, and then I'll turn it over to Adiba, and Adiba is going to talk about why we're doing this project and just give you an overview again, just so you're familiar with that. And then after Adiba, Kathleen will talk about what's included in this project in terms of the different health topics that are included. And then she's actually going to demo the trauma tab, which is part of our online tool for this project. And then Haley will talk about how this product will be used and who we anticipate using it across Clark County. So let me just start by explaining the work of the health assessment and evaluation team. So we work across four foundational public health areas, including assessment and surveillance, community partnership development, and public health programs such as chronic disease prevention and injury prevention, housing and mental health, substance use and maternal and child family health. And we work on initializing data from a lot of different, utilizing data from a lot of different sources, public health, social services, healthcare in the community, monitoring data, leading causes of diseases and death, health behaviors and social factors influencing health, identifying trends, disparities, and emerging health issues. And I mentioned the community partnerships to really address priority health issues. And then this guides program and policy development along with implementation and evaluation. We provide technical assistance not only across public health but also to partners across Clark County, all related to data, whether it's data collection, analyzing data, interpreting data, and then reporting on the data. And then we also support public health emergency response. So I'll turn it over to Adiba.
Thank you. So I just want to share a little bit about why we're even working on a project like this. So a strategic goal of our department and our team is to be able to use data for decision making so that all of our programs are evidence-based. And on a day-to-day basis, the epidemiologists, we look at a variety of different data sources. And we work with our staff and we work with community partners to make sure that data is being used for decision making and planning. But we also recognize that data doesn't feel accessible sometimes, even though a lot of this data is available publicly. It's not interpretable, and so we're really here to develop a tool that community partners, schools, leaders, and the public can utilize. And so we created a platform and so that folks can see maps of some of the critical health indicators that we use on the Healthy Communities team that addresses some of the topics that David mentioned, like chronic disease, maternal child health, behavioral health, substance use. And we wanted this tool to be interactive, make the data accessible, and really address the topics that we focus on, as well as the social factors that influence health. So we actually partnered with the county GIS department to develop this tool that we're calling the Healthier Clark County InfoMaps. And it's an interactive online public facing platform. And so today we're going to be demoing this tool for you. It's not live yet, but it will be hopefully in the next couple of weeks. So I'm going to hand it over to Kathleen so she can tell you a little bit about what's in the tool.
Yes, so this is it. This is the Healthier Clark County Info Map. This is our homepage that you will go to that will just give kind of an overview of what's in there and what it's all about. And data in this tool will include 10 different topic areas, and each topic area will have its own tab at the top, which you can't see very well on the screen, but
each of those little tabs is a topic area, and the first includes demographics, and this is like data from the census, race, ethnicity, and age breakdown. And then we'll also have data on the social determinants of health, or these social factors that influence health that Adiba was talking about, because we know that our health is influenced by much more than our access to health care. It's influenced by all the conditions around us, including our access to affordable and safe housing, our access to fruits and vegetables, our environment and the air we breathe, and our safe communities and our social connectedness. So we wanted to recognize that a lot of times those factors influence our health more than the quality of health care we receive, and so those will also be in this social determinants of health tab. And then we also have data on maternal health, which will include things like utilization of preterm or prenatal care, gestational diabetes, and then also some infant outcomes like low birth weight and premature birth. And then we also have a child health topic that will include basically everything that you would discuss with a doctor at a well-child visit, like nutrition, physical activity, how they're doing in school, and we also have some indicators around screen time and too much screen time, so that will be in there. We have two tabs around chronic disease, one focused on adults and the other on youth, which will also have some of these risk factors for chronic disease, like nutrition and physical activity, and also high cholesterol and high blood pressure, things like that. And then adult behavioral health, which will include mental health indicators for adults, as well as some indicators around the deaths of despair, which are overdose deaths, alcohol-related deaths, and suicide. And then a substance use tab, which will include indicators around vaping, marijuana, tobacco, drinking, things like that. And then also an adverse childhood experiences tab around trauma, which is the one we'll be demoing today. But basically, each of these tabs will have maps for all the indicators, either by census tract, or a zip code, or a school district, depending on where the data comes from. And then those maps will be accompanied by some narrative text and some charts and graphs to round it out. So we want to demo with you the Adverse Childhood Experiences tab. So when you first go to a tab, you'll kind of go to this sort of about section, which will give you a overview of what the topic is and why it's important. For those that are unaware, ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, are any kind of trauma or abuse that are experienced in childhood. And we know from research that these can have lasting impacts on brain development and risk for chronic disease later in life, including heart disease, diabetes, or substance use disorders. So there will be kind of an overview of the topic once you go in there, and then scrolling down, it'll give you examples of how you can address this issue and what Clark County Public Health is doing and some other resources. And then, scrolling down further, we'll take you to what we're calling an Adverse Childhood Experiences Index, or an ACES Index. And this is basically a summary statistic of all of the indicators that go into this tab, which are listed down below here. They include things like physical abuse, emotional abuse, exposure to violence, and then we also included some indicators around mental health that can be kind of a symptom of trauma. And so what this index is doing is just taking all of these indicators and making them into one summary statistic so that we can kind of compare how different areas of the county are doing on average. So this will show the different school districts, because this data is coming from the Healthy Youth Survey, which is done with 6th, 8th, 10th, and 12th graders in schools. So the darker gray areas are representative of areas that are doing, on average, a lot better on all of these indicators. Like the abuse, they have lower rates of abuse and trauma. And then the lighter gray areas are doing kind of average in the middle on all of these indicators. And then the orange areas are the ones that are doing, on average, worse on all of these indicators. They maybe have higher rates of abuse or neglect. And these are the areas that we want to call out, not as problem areas, but as areas where we can have a high impact or a high opportunity for change with implementing trauma-informed strategies. So an interpretation, or how to interpret this index, is also included in this left-hand sidebar. By clicking on the map itself, it will also give you an interpretation that you can utilize, and then the legend on the side will also give you some indication of what the colors mean. And every single one of, or not every single one, but most of the tabs will have one of these indexes that kind of serves as like a summary of what all of this means and where we might be focusing on each of these topics. So we'll have like a maternal health index, we'll have a child's health index, and chronic disease indexes as well. And if you continue to scroll down, this is where you'll get to the actual indicators that go into the index. So this is for anxiety. So this map is showing rates of anxiety among 10th graders within each school district area. The legend will give you a range that their rate is falling in. Generally, the lighter the color, the better they're doing, and the darker, the worse the outcome. But you can also click on a area of interest and it will show you the rate for, this is Battleground, so it'll show you the rate for Battleground School District. And then also the Clark County rate and the Washington State rate, so you can compare and have that data right in there. And then on the sidebar on the side, we have just a little description of what this is and why it's, what this indicator is and why it's important, what's on the map. And then we also have some more charts with some comparisons to the state, and disparities and trends were available. And you can click on these charts and they will get bigger so you can analyze them more closely. We also include a data source at the bottom of each of these. So if you would like to just take a snippet and plop it into a presentation or a report that you're making, you can also do that. And then we also have disparities by different demographic groups right here. That will also be another chart. And then by just continuing moving down, you can see all of the other indicators that go into this topic area, this ACEs topic area. So depression, moving down, you'll see a map of not having adult support, and so on. We also have these little dots on the side, which will show you the topics that are included. So if you're just interested in a specific topic area, say I'm only interested in rates of physical abuse, I can just click on that dot and it will go straight there. And then you can also use these arrows to move up and down, and then home button will take you back to this main area that talks about the topic. So this is going to be the general layout of all of the tabs. We're still working out some of the goal details and finishing up, and so all of our tabs are still under construction, but we just wanted to give you an overview of what would look like and how you could use this tool.
So on the back table, and maybe you already picked it up, there's a one-page handout that kind of describes those different topic areas that Kathleen just mentioned. So if you don't remember, that's okay. That's back there for your reference. And I just wanted to briefly, before we get to kind of questions, share a little bit about how we see the potential for this tool to be used. We know that internally, our internal public health staff will use this tool to access the data, look at maps to really inform their program planning or their strategic priorities. But we're really viewing this tool as something for the Clark County community, so broader than just our staff here at Public Health. We really hope that this website can encourage community members or community-based nonprofits, local coalitions, our elected officials, really encourage them to kind of explore the data, look through these data sets that we have the privilege of looking at every day and digging into all the time, but really creating this tool that makes it easier to dig in and look at what's happening in the community and maybe think about how we can all play a role in supporting the health and well-being of Clark County residents. In creating this, we're joining a lot of local health jurisdictions across the state who are really working to make data more accessible and actionable for folks in the community. So we're excited to have created this kind of interactive tool for the community. This kind of information, we've worked on projects like this in the past in more of a kind of static PDF format, so I just wanted to share a couple of examples of how this kind of population health data has been used in the past. Several years ago, our team did a similar analysis of all the different data sources that we look at and made maps and looked at a lot of different health outcomes and those social influencers of health that we look at a lot. And as a result of that analysis, the Fourth Plain Corridor in Central Vancouver really popped out as an area where we were seeing a lot of health issues and disparities in comparison to the rest of the county. And so as I know that you all have heard about and are aware of as a result of that, in the years since, there's been this really robust multi-sector initiative focused around the Fourth Plain Corridor and Clark County Public Health and the City of Vancouver and several other community-based organizations and nonprofits have really supported that work. And today that work is focused kind of on three areas: affordable housing, safe streets, and economic opportunity. And that work has really leveraged a lot of dollars. They recently received a grant, a $3 million grant from the state to work on an affordable housing complex called the Fourth Plain Common. So that's one example of how kind of this place, this mapped data can really help us identify areas to focus resources and strategic priorities. Another example of using this population health data, we work with a lot with our local prevent coalitions who are really focused on substance use prevention. And a lot of the indicators that Kathleen just shared from the Healthy Youth Survey, they are looking at and asking us for a lot and really using to help inform their program planning. And so we're really excited that this can now be a tool where they can sit down at their computers with students in the high schools to look at the data, or with teachers or principals, and spend less time kind of like wrangling a data table and more time on doing the prevention work in the community. So those are just a few examples of how this kind of data can be used. Our next steps in terms of kind of disseminating this tool, you're our first group that we've showed it to outside of like our small group here. But we're planning several presentations of the Healthier Clark County Info Map, including with superintendents of the school districts here in Clark County. We'll be presenting to them in early March, as well as our Board of Health, our local community, or our Clark County Community Services Department here in the building. And we'll also disseminate, once it goes live here pretty soon, we'll disseminate snapshots and highlights through the county social media and also on the website. And we're really hoping to plan some sort of I'm going to say, roadshow across the county to share the tool with our community partners. And then lastly, this is kind of a first phase of this community priorities work that we're doing. We know that data, this quantitative data is what we call it, is really important and tells us a lot of information, but we know it doesn't tell the full story of what's happening in our community. So we're actively thinking through our next phase where we really go out into the community and collect more of that qualitative information to help us not just understand what's happening, but more importantly, figure out what we're going to do to address some of the issues that is coming up through the data and through our conversations with community partners and community members in Clark County.
Great, thank you. So now we just want to open it up to get your reflections on this tool and obviously open it up for any questions that you might have. Yeah.
I was wondering if you had partnered with the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board and consulted with their epidemiology center as the sovereign nation of this area, because this ACE has been talked about in our community, and even looking through the statistics that showed briefly on the screen, you can see that American Indians have the highest rate of these ACEs scores when it comes to things, but they're considered or they are a much smaller population. So you have more hurt kids that are Native. And when you look at your prevention pieces, I don't know if you can pull that up, I don't see that you've addressed culture. We have determined in our communities that culture is your best practice for healing and addressing the ACEs scores, especially how they're tied to diabetes. I actually sit on the federal committee, the Tribal Leaders Diabetes Committee, and there's the links between ACEs and diabetes and how all of that can change brains and all of those things. I'm more acutely aware of it than possible. But I just would maybe ask, when we're doing these things in the community, that you consult with the tribes or the tribes epidemiology center, which is housed in Portland.
Okay.
And then also consider the best practices that go along with socioeconomic groups, because those are healing things that actually can reverse the ACEs score and can make better as we address the issues in our own communities.
Great, thanks. That's a great suggestion. And I think that will be part of the phase two when we go out into the community and really hear from them. So we'll definitely include.
I would offer that as a suggestion. They have an amazing epidemiology center at the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board, and that covers Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
Great, thank you. Appreciate that.
David, I have a similar comment. I was just this week looking at a report that's coming out now from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, looking at child outcomes in terms of being able, so they have an interactive map that looks at census tract data and breaks down the population by Hispanics, white, blacks, and then looks at the death rates. You can, you know, we've heard that kids can be in two different zip codes. One can have life expectancy of 85 years, the other one only 60 years. You know, the variance that we can learn from. And so as I was looking at that, is there going to be? I haven't had enough time to explore that website that much. But it's coming from some good data source. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that should be linked. That the phase two should be to link into some of the other databases that are really important. And I think that's a pretty credible database that they've created that's interactive by going by, but it's by census tract. And so that's a part two of the question is, you talk about school districts, are you breaking that down by census tract or by zip code or how?
So we're limited to what we can do based on the data sources we have. So what Kathleen was sharing was a lot of the youth data that come from the Healthy Youth Survey, and the smallest level of geography we can show here is school district.
Uh-huh.
We're also going to show a lot of adult health data, and that comes from another survey called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. And so for those maps, you're going to see it drilled down to the zip code level.
Okay.
And then we're going to have some maps that show social determinants of health, which come from the census. And for those data, it's going to drill down to the zip code.
Okay.
So
really, we're going to, so most of the data sources that Robert would jump, no, the report you're referring to, it's going to be similar to the data sources we use, and when they have mortality data, they can drill down to census tract, things like that. So we're going to, our goal is to get, you know, as detailed as we can with what sources we have.
And then the third part of that question is, you know, we're talking about school districts, census data, and zip codes. Can you, you know, as you develop this info map, can you create a document that would show the overlay of zip codes on top of census tracts on top of school districts, so that if you wanted to pinpoint an area, some data might be available by zip code, some data might be available by census tract, some, you know, can we create an overlay of three maps that say, okay, this neighborhood is part of this zip code, this census tract, and this school district. Does that make sense? I think that would be really useful because we're mixing, you know, with census tract and zip code, we're mixing apples and oranges, and so at least overlay them.
I just want to say nice job, guys. That's really impressive work. So a question for you guys. So what was the biggest debate on the team as you guys were doing this work?
On our team of three or on our
own? Yeah, team of three.
Well, the name.
Yeah, very technical.
Yeah, we had
name. Yeah. We had a last minute name change.
Yes. I mean, I think when we first started, we had a big discussion of what indicators are going to go into this tool. And we engaged kind of our bigger Healthy Communities team, and we had a voting process, and we really wanted to make sure we include, because we have additional EPI staff in our department that do just communicable diseases. And our staff is really dedicated to all the non-infectious conditions. So we really wanted to highlight everything else. And so, yeah, we had a voting process. We tried to incorporate what we could and also highlight kind of the most, you know, emerging, the hot topics as well. And so where some things fell off, we tried to incorporate it in other areas. So.
And what was realistic for the resources?
This already feels like a lot, but there was actually a lot more. We wanted to try and incorporate some crime data, some more school data, but I think it'll come out in another project.
And I do just want to say, I can't see your name tag, but is it Joan or Jane?
I'm Joan. Yeah.
Joan. There will be a life expectancy by census tract. That is one map that we've included in our social determinants of health tab. So.
And what's your rollout date? I mean, what's your target right now? I can't wait for my students to see this. But
hopefully within a month. Most by the
early March.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll let you know the second it's
online. Oh, I'm very excited about this. This is fabulous.
And I have to say that this is definitely an iterative process, and this will morph and change over time. And as we identify some additional tools to help to bring some more robust, you know, tools to this process, this is going to change over time. But we've gone from having these sort of dry data sheets that you could just sort of print off, right, to this, where you can actually slice and dice the data and download it into presentations. And it's really a much more user-friendly way of presenting the data. And it also, it makes it easier to come up with those really compelling questions like you were talking about. Whereas before, if you're just looking at data sheets, it's really, really hard to really see it. This helps people to really envision it. And it's going to change over time, and it'll definitely change as we go through that qualitative process. But what I really love about it is that they've really built a very good foundation to build on. And it really meets the needs of what we were hearing from the community, too. So we've done just a fantastic job.
The other great advantage of this is it's control in the hands of the community. It's not like we're just making maps and giving them to people. But anybody can do this. They can do this at their own home or wherever they are, community center or wherever. But it puts people in the community, wherever they are, can ask whatever, you know, if we have the data for it, they can ask a question about the data.
You know, another data system is, I don't know if you've seen the work that the Council for the Homeless has done on the HMIS system.
Oh, yeah.
Where you can go, you can just get all the data. I mean,
we looked at that.
That is incredible. So hopefully that will be, you know, you can look at that as well, articulating that HMIS data.
I have a question. Well, first of all, I think this is terrific.
I love that it's going to be very accessible, because I think the more people that use it, then the better it will really become, because they will have even more people experimenting with it and really learning about it and being able to contribute. It becomes generative, and I think that's wonderful. One thing, and maybe this was mentioned, and I just missed it because it's a lot of really important information that you covered. But when I, if I were able to look and see situations based on their seriousness or prevalence or those kinds of things, kind of maybe parceled out that way. What I also want to see, somehow connected to it or related or whatever, is kind of like what of those things are easy to fix, hard to fix, or somewhere in between, so that I can create a priority matrix that says I'm going to start with those serious things that are easy to fix. You see what I'm saying? And I don't know, I'm not sure how or where you would get reliable information about that. I think in some cases it would be really easy, but in some cases it might be so difficult it's not worth the effort. But that, is there anything like that associated with this? What kind of direct the user into a prioritization process?
I guess, are you thinking that the user would define that, or you think it's already defined?
I think there's probably already a lot of information about that. Some things we just know are very difficult to address. Some things we know, there are solutions that work. So, but if I'm the user, I might know that what the problems are that I'm aware of that are serious, and it may identify them as serious or high prevalence. But would it also guide me as to which of those things has a remedy available or has research going on around that, or it's just so difficult that you could put a ton of resources into it and not net a very much of a result at all.
I'm not sure that there's a tool out there like that, but also I'm wondering, is that the answer, or is it also what's most effective, you know, to fix the problem? That's maybe another way
I think
to look
that's
at
what
it.
I'm saying is that we know that something, there's a lot of activity going on or actions being taken, but not necessarily netting a positive outcome.
Right.
I have one question, or GIS in Clark County is really good, and you're being tied in that. I've used GIS in other counties, and it doesn't even compare to us.
We agree.
what I'd like to see is that you guys have your own special heading when they put up enter Clark County GIS, and this comes up as one of the categories, because if you get kind of under something else, there's a lot of data there, but it's kind of behind something else, where somebody punches in the computer, it comes right up that it's the healthier Clark County information. You got your kind of your own section to it, because there's so many different departments or sections in to it, where somebody can find it a lot easier. A lot of this data that I use, people that I work with, they've learned by playing with GIS on how to find it. So if this could just really stand out, they hit GIS, and you know, there's a list of things, property information, and some of the others. If you write it as one of the major headings, I think people will see it a lot more.
It's your own brand.
Yeah, we like that. Thanks.
Does this live on the county website, or will it be its own website?
It will live on the county website. It's not live yet, but yeah, it'll be in public health's website.
And did you look at what other jurisdictions are doing with regard to health and home apps? I'm just curious.
Yeah, we looked at Spokane. What were the other counties that we looked at?
I mean, I think most other jurisdictions throughout the country are using maps in this way. So we've been, you know, we have a really great assessment epidemiology community within Washington State, as well as across the river. And so we're constantly sharing resources. And so Seattle, Tacoma, I mean, just in our own state are some of our colleagues that we've been sharing with.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. David, will we be able to, you know, I think back to when we worked on the Growing Healthier Clark County report, and we looked at, you know, those 8 social determinants of health, and we talked a lot about environmental health. You know, we talked about, well, you know, just the whole issue of where are our septic tanks located. Is there going to be potential in the platform to add in other, you know, like environmental, like polluted streams or septic tanks, because then you begin to look at, you know, are the septic tanks in areas that are causing more illness than in other, you know, because of the leaking into the water table. I mean, are we going to be able to get to those environmental things that are in the future?
Yeah, potentially down the road.
There's a fair amount of environmental stuff now, like septic tank locations by parcel, water wells, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It could be expanded probably, but there's a lot of this there now.
Okay, great.
Can you give me an example of the kind of qualitative questions that you're looking to ask and how that could change this information? Just I'm having a hard time envisioning like what that looks like.
That's kind of what we're in the phase of the planning right now and really trying to figure out what we want to focus on. It's not going to change the data, but it may change future iterations if we hear from the community that environmental health is a huge priority and we want to see more environmental health data in a platform like this. But also I think that the qualitative component, we're really going to try to partner with others who are already kind of doing these types of data collection efforts in the community, so we're not constantly asking the community, but also really to focus and help our department, our team, Healthy Communities, think about our own strategic plan and how we can address some of these issues. So not necessarily focusing on the needs assessment piece so much, because we have a lot of data and we have a regional assessment that really looked at what are the health needs in our area, but really what are we going to do about it, and how can we do that in partnership with organizations and others in the community.
So I think, you know, hearing from them, like, what are the priorities in their community? And I think, as Haley said, we want to be really careful that we don't ask the same questions that these communities have been asked over and over again if they do get surveyed to death. So we're talking to all our partners in terms of what kind of assessments and surveys have they already done and not being duplicated.
So when you do that, when you go and do some of these qualitative process, are you going to share some of the quantitative data with folks and ask them what kind of meaning it has for them?
Yeah.
Assume you're going to have similar to what your presentation is here and then ask folks, what does this mean to you living in this community with these data?
Right.
That's part of the, okay.
Yeah, but like Haley said, we haven't planned, we're not quite there yet to plan what kind of questions were asked, but yeah, I think that's a great suggestion.
I think this next phase is also going to try and address kind of what Marla brought up.
Yeah.
How do we prioritize? Because this isn't a prioritization. This is kind of all the data here for people to explore. But we know that it doesn't tell the whole story. There are communities that are, you know, risk for various things that doesn't necessarily come out in the data. They don't fit into one of the race boxes or, you know, any of the categories that we have to use. So kind of filling in those gaps and then helping us with prioritizing health issues and then identifying ways to address.
And also along with, if I heard Mala correctly, one of the things would be just looking at, if you're working with communities and showing them the data, not just showing them the problems, but talking to them about what assets they have as well.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So figuring out how they can address some of these, some of the issues.
Yeah.
Well, an example might be, if one of the things that comes up is that we're having problems with outbreaks of conditions that are preventable, and you can say, okay, well, we know that immunization is the number one way to manage the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So then I don't have to go try to figure that out because you already know that.
Right.
That's what I'm kind of trying to get to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in each kind of topic area, there will be, I know it's impossible to see the text on this screen back there, but there's an area where we link out to kind of trusted resources that we refer to a lot when it comes to how do we address diabetes in our community. So there'll be that kind of level of resource. We're not telling you what to do, but we'll link to resources throughout the tool.
That's great.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Speaking of just using diabetes as an example, somebody brought up environmental health, but are you guys going to be able to do map food deserts and food swamps and stuff like that at some point? Because if you find areas where there's more, for example, diabetes and hypertension, maybe there isn't access to supermarkets, you know, grocery stores in those areas. So I don't know whether that overlay will be available down the road. But it's also getting what Marla was saying about thinking about, okay, we've got diabetes in the same road, but the nearest grocery store is, you know, 5 miles away. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether there's a plan to look at some of that, or there's parks and things like that.
Yeah, there's some of those tools already available that, like Haley said, we could probably link to. So you guys want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think once this launches, we have ideas about how we can expand, including environmental health data, food data, maybe have this be its own project. So there's a lot that we'd like to do using maps.
Yeah, all this, all these questions you're giving us is really helpful as we think about planning for phase two. So this is great.
I will say from like a prevention standpoint, it's like a really valuable resource because like I've gone through the Healthy Youth Survey and tried to like pick out points. And especially with the group of teens, it's really hard to focus on something if it's not like visual, like a map that you're using. And to have that information consolidated into one thing is really nice because a lot of people are visual learners. And so it's a platform that everybody can understand no matter like what race you are or your academic standing. And I think that's really great in this whole thing.
Great. Thank you, Kate. Any other questions?
For our presenters, David and his team?
Good job.
Thank you.
David had one more thing to add. Go ahead, go ahead.
So before we move on to departmental updates, last year I came and talked about our child death review team. So that's a team of multidisciplinary experts from across the county that review cases of unnatural children's death from birth to age 19. And we've gone through 1 year of that team reviewing cases. And you may remember I talked about there's about 25 unnatural deaths in Clark County for children per year. And so now we actually are looking at recommendations because, as I talked about last year, our focus is really on prevention. So we reviewed several cases related to sudden and unexpected infant death. And in reviewing those cases, what we found out is that parents, when after they're giving birth, they're just bombarded with so much information, and safe sleep, although it's part of the information that they get, it's just embedded in like all this paperwork. It's not culturally sensitive information, and it wasn't in any languages that are predominantly spoken in Clark County. So we brought together a smaller team of experts to talk about what can we do, what kind of resources can we provide parents at birthing centers and hospitals. And what we came up with, I'll pass this around, is a one-page document that is actually separate from all the other information they get when they're leaving the hospital or the birthing centers. And then also this sign that they actually hang on the baby's door, bedroom door, or the parents' door if the baby's sleeping with them, around some safe sleep tips as a reminder. So I'll just pass this around. And we did this in, obviously, English, but also in Spanish, Russian, and Chinese. Any questions about that?
I just want to say I think that's really great action to come out of the work that you did. And I think you mentioned this before when you were here maybe, but of the 25 unnatural deaths in Clark County per year, were the majority of them related to unsafe sleeping practices?
So I think if I remember right, Kathleen, do you remember the top two issues? Is it sudden unexpected infant death and suicide?
Yeah, but it can fluctuate from year to year,
right,
when we only have 25. Right.
Yeah.
So there can be some differences from year to year, but in 2018, I think the top two were the sudden unexplained infant deaths and suicide.
Well, that actually makes sense, and it kind of goes to what I said before. If, even if the sudden unexplained infant death is not the top thing, if it's something that we know we can prevent, then that's where to put the energy, it seems like.
All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for a great presentation.
Thanks.
Good job.
Goodbye.
So the next thing that we have on our agenda tonight is a legislative update from Dr. Lee.
Yeah, and I'm just going to go talk about a few things. There's a long list of things we could talk about with the legislative update. I'm going to talk about a couple of the priority items. One of them is banking legislation. So the emergency rule around vaping. Remember we had that outbreak that's kind of leveled diminished significantly about e-cigarette and vaping associated lung injury or E-Valley. So there was an emergency rule put into effect that basically banned flavored products, flavored vaping products. It made vaping notifiable, it made it a notifiable condition, things like that. There was a couple of bills, and supported by the governor, was House Bill 2454 and Senate Bill 6254. I guess the numbers aren't that important, but it would have banned all flavored vaping products. It went to the Ways and Means Committee. It was approved by the Senate Health and Long-Term Care Committee, the substitute bill 6254, and then it was referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The substitute actually changed the definition of flavored vaping products to exclude tobacco and menthol, and allows the sale of flavored vapor products only in retail outlets available to folks 21 and older. And then it put an excise tax on flavored vaping products and directed the money to foundational public health services. You know, I'm not sure exactly why this happened. I know there were some concerns from folks in the vaping world that adults who use vaping products as harm reduction techniques like to use menthol products for that. I don't know if that's what caused this, but the bill has been changed somewhat. And I think the excise tax was a way, and I'm going to get into this in a minute, the excise tax was a way of replacing the foundational public health services funding that was lost because the vape taxes, the revenue from the vape tax is well way down, which I'm going to get into in a minute. So the flavor bill has changed somewhat. I don't know if anybody has any questions about that. I don't know what's going to happen to it. The way foundational, two sessions ago, the state provided funding for foundational public health services. You may remember $22 million it was kind of like a down payment on foundational public health services. And that was for this biennium, which includes 2021. When we ended up, so half of that revenue, half of that $22 million or foundational public health services came from the vape tax. Well, given what happened this past several months, vaping, this is the problem when you base funding on a so-called sin tax. When we had this outbreak of E-Valley, and then we had the flavor ban, vaping use went way down, and consequently the vaping tax revenue went way down. So we were faced with a $10.5 million shortfall and the $22 million for foundational public health services. The governor and some legislators proposed House Bill 2679, companion bill, Senate Bill 6451, that would replenish that revenue from taxing excessive surplus that the nonprofit health insurance companies have. So that would there's three of them: Regents, Premier, and Kaiser. Apparently, they have to have some sort of fund balance in case bad things happen. So their fund balance is actually $4 billion. So some folks consider that excessive. So the original bill said that it was gonna, they were gonna tax, I'm not sure I'm explaining this right, but about tax the whatever's available 400% above what's called a risk-based capital requirements. So the risk-based capital requirements, the amount that they're supposed to have available, but they're way above that. So the original plan was to tax if they're 400% above that, and then it was changed, it was amended to make it 600% above that. That left Kaiser off the hook, but Premera and Regents are still there. There's some controversy as to whether that is an appropriate funding source or, you know, for revenue like this. So that there's another bill, and I'm not sure what's going to happen with this, by Representative Pollitt, which would change the bait tax method to a 45% excise tax, and it creates a 4.4% B&O surcharge on manufacturers and distributors of cigarettes and other tobacco products. So that would bring in $10 million. I don't know where these bills are going to go, but the bottom line is, right now we have a shortage of basically half of what the Foundational Public Health Services account was. Original plan was, and I'm going to get into Foundational Public Health Services right now. If anybody has any questions about them, I'm happy to describe what they are. But the original plan for the Foundational Public Health Services was to distribute these funds to both local health jurisdictions and tribal organizations in lump sum payments in 6-month allocation. So we get 6 months at a time, but because we're unsure about the revenue, DOH is on the State Department of Health. Well, the state is going to give us the amount in 3-month increments rather than 6-month increments. Hopefully, we'll find out soon whether the FPHS funding is replaced somehow by either of these methods. I don't know if any folks have any questions about that. I don't know if I explained that well enough, but if my colleagues will tell me if I'm okay. Any questions about Foundational Public Health Services or the vaping legislation?
Today's the cutoff, right, for House Ways and Means. I think it is today, right? For it to come
the 11th, I believe, yes. Yeah. But some of these bills are what's the title, necessary to implement the budget. So there's some things that can go on longer if they're NTIB. And this may be one of those, and I can find that out. But yeah, we're more than halfway through the session now. Okay. What's next? Flu report? So the good news about influenza is that the activity continues to decrease. We're at week 5 of the year now. The bad news is that we're still in the flu season. So whenever 10% or more of the tests that are ordered by healthcare providers are positive for influenza, that's still considered the flu season, and we're at 21.4%. The other difference is that early on in the flu season, we're seeing more influenza B. Now we're beginning to see more influenza A. Influenza A tends to be a bit more severe than influenza B in terms of outcomes. Influenza B was, I think this year was particularly a problem for young children. But anyway, the bottom line is we're still in the flu season. For those of you who haven't gotten your flu shot yet, there's still time to do that because it takes up to 2 weeks to build immunity. And given the rate that we're going, it could be many weeks, you know, several weeks before we're out of the flu season. I don't know if anybody has any questions about that.
I just heard that I think the flu vaccine that most of us got is predominantly for the influenza A and didn't cover B.
No, B was covered.
B was covered, yeah. Both?
Both A and B. So there's a trivalent and a quadrivalent, and the quadrivalent gets 2 types of B and 2 A's, and the trivalent gets 1 B and 2 A's. It's all there, but anyway. In terms of how effective it's going to be this year, we won't know until basically the end of the flu season when we have the data. Generally, it's it, from year to year fluctuates, but generally it's about 40 to 60% effective. That's a lot better than doing nothing. I mean, if I had a device that, you know, gave me a 40 to 60% chance of having a severe injury or death, you know, better, I would take it. So still the best thing we can do for influenza. And actually, it makes my head explode because everybody, we're going to get on to the next topic. But, you know, there's all this hype about coronavirus, and we need to be vigilant about that. But right now, influenza is killing, you know, every year in the United States, it kills tens of thousands of people. So take influenza really seriously. Yeah. Any questions, Beth?
Speaking of coronavirus.
Okay. So there's a really great website that Johns Hopkins has where you can call it the map of the world, and it will show you the number of cases of coronavirus. It's in real time, so it'll show you it over time. And I'd be happy to share that URL with anybody who wants to know. But I checked it at 11:30 this morning. And at 11:30 this morning, there were 43,146 cases. There had been 43,100, I'm sure you want these exact, it's changed by now, okay, this is this morning. There were over 43,000 cases of coronavirus. We're talking about novel coronavirus. Let me say something else about coronavirus, because it can get very confusing. Coronavirus is a fairly common respiratory virus, and it can cause a common cold. And what we're talking about is novel coronavirus and new coronavirus. Other examples of coronavirus a number of years ago was SARS, if you remember SARS, and then there was MERS, or Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, a few years ago. Those are variants of the coronavirus. The kinds of disease that coronavirus can cause can range from a cold to severe illness, like SARS was severe adult respiratory syndrome, is pretty severe. We don't know yet, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, how severe this novel, it's called 2019 novel coronavirus, how severe it's going to be. One of the reasons we don't know how severe it's going to be is we have some death data, but we don't know how many people there are who are infected who don't even have symptoms or have mild symptoms who haven't been tested. It looks like so far the mortality data is around 2% or so, but we don't have a whole lot of data about that yet. Okay, as of this morning, there were 43,146 cases of novel coronavirus. 42,670 of them were in mainland China. And the rest, so about, you know, less than 1,000 outside of China, more like about 500 outside of China, almost 43,000 in mainland China, including Hubei, where this whole thing started. There have been 1,018 deaths and 4,347 folks that have recovered. There have been 13 cases in the United States, one in Washington, and that person has recovered. That person didn't acquire it in Washington. They had traveled. And then we have one person under investigation. I'll talk about what that means, but that's in the state of Washington.
You know, Alan, it's like, you know, but to put that into perspective, what did I just see? The CDC said right now there's been 22 million cases of flu.
Oh,
in
God,
US,
yeah.
You know, it's just, that, to put it into context, you know, it's, you don't know, again, the mortality rate of that, you know, as you're talking about it, but still, how many, what's the mortality rate of flu?
Well, the mortality rate of flu is probably lower than, I think it's lower than 2%. I think it's lower than 1%, but it's still, given the number of cases, is pretty significant. And when you think that a small percentage of the U.S. population is immunized for flu, I mean, I'm reading something, we don't have exact data on that, but I'm reading something like 40% or less people don't get the flu shot. That's pretty significant. Okay. As I said, the symptoms, we don't know about it much yet. So, for example, we don't know we don't know exactly what the incubation period is. We believe it's from 2 to 14 days. We think it's no longer than 14 days. We don't know when people are contagious with it. So for influenza, for example, we know that you're contagious a day or two before you develop symptoms, and then you're contagious, you know, early on while you have symptoms. I'm trying to remember how long you're contagious for, but, you know, measles, we knew it was when you have the prodrome, the runny nose, the cough, the red eyes, the fever, And 4 days after rash onset, we know you're contagious. We don't know if people who are infected with coronavirus, novel coronavirus, are infected when they don't have symptoms. Mm-hmm. We're not sure about that yet. And we don't know how long you're contagious for after you develop symptoms. But it's probably likely that when you develop symptoms, you're probably contagious. Mm-hmm. We do know, so the original coronavirus started in live animal markets in Wuhan. And, there's a connection to animals. I mean, I've heard bats and snakes. But it looks like, from what we know of, that person-to-person transmission, human-to-human transmission is possible. And there was just recently in Chicago, we had a case in the U.S. First case in the U.S. It was a result of person-to-person transmission. I believe it was a couple, and one of them infected the other. We're concerned about our folks who are arriving from mainland China. Prior to the 2nd of February, the main concern was just Wuhan Wuhan is within Hubei province. There was concern about those folks. The CDC, given what's happening in mainland China, the CDC changed their recommendation that anybody returning from mainland China after, I think it was 2 p.m. February 2nd, we needed to be somewhat concerned about. So they've defined risk categories in terms of somebody who might be at risk for developing coronavirus. One is somebody who lives in the same household or is an intimate partner of or who provides health care without using protection for somebody who's a laboratory confirmed case. And then the other high risk right now is travel from Hubei, where the epicenter is. The medium risk might be somebody who traveled from mainland China and is asymptomatic right now. They may be a medium risk. I'm not going to go into all the categories. They're on the CDC site. We can get that information available to you. I could go on and on about this, but the main issue here is most of the public right now in Clark County is the risk is really remote. What we're doing is folks who are medium or high risk or asymptomatic, don't have symptoms, we're asking them to stay home, do a home voluntary quarantine for 14 days. And we're monitoring them. If they're very high risk, we're doing active monitoring. We're actually contacting them every day and asking them how they're doing and asking them questions. If they're medium risk, let's say they traveled from mainland China outside of Hubei and they're asymptomatic and it's been less than 14 days, we're asking them to self-monitor and for symptoms and call us, not just run to the doctor's office in the emergency department if they get sick, but to contact us. The people who are persons under investigation are people who fit into the medium and high risk category but also have symptoms. And those folks have been isolated and are undergoing medical evaluation. That's what we mean by persons under investigation. Right now in Washington State,
How is the 2 week, how is that determined? Is that kind of random?
No, it's not random. It's basically based on experience. I mean, there have been 42,000 cases. So the data that, we've looked at, it seems like 14 weeks is the incubation period. So that's where the 14 days came from. From the time of exposure, from the data we have so far, to the time that, it ranges from 2 to 14 days. But we have pretty good evidence, or at least the CDC has evidence, that it's not longer than 14 days. To give you an idea of the numbers that we're seeing in Washington State, yesterday, there was one confirmed case I told you about. And by the way, confirmation is by laboratory confirmation of the organism itself. 22 negatives. Right now, in this whole state of Washington, to give you an idea, there's one person under investigation. There's one person who fits the medium or high risk category who also has symptoms. That's in the whole state of Washington. So I'm not saying that we don't need to be vigilant about this. We certainly do. There are some travelers here in Clark County that are asymptomatic, that are not under active monitoring. They're not high risk, but we're in contact with them. We've given them information about what to look for, and we are in contact with them. When when people travel from mainland China and come to the U.S., we get the information from the Department of Health about who's in our community and who's traveled from mainland China. So we are getting that information. We are giving them information, and they're not high risk. We're asking them to monitor themselves. So I don't know that if that's helpful or not, but right now the other folks that are being monitored are close contacts to a confirmed case. And given that first case, that only case in Washington was in Snohomish County, there are 12 close contacts of that case that are being monitored. King has 5, Skagit has 1, and Whatcom has 1. There's 19 close contacts to that Snohomish case that are still being monitored. And they'll be monitored for 14 days post-exposure to that case in Snohomish. I know I'm blabbering here, so I hope what I'm saying makes sense. So if we are to have a case here in Clark County, you know, let's say we have a person under investigation and they become ill. So somebody who's high risk develops symptoms, we test them and they're positive. We're going to be doing the same drill that we did with measles. We're going to be doing interviews, finding out where they might have been, why they might have been contagious, who they had contact with when we think they might have been contagious, and monitoring those folks as well. And if they've been exposed to a case, a laboratory confirmed case, and didn't have protection, need appropriate protection, let's say it was a healthcare worker without the appropriate protection, we'll be having them in quarantine and we'll be doing active monitoring on them. Just kind of like we did with the measles. When we had a case of measles and we had susceptibles who were exposed, we had them do voluntary home quarantine and we actively monitor them. So we will be doing the same drill if we have novel coronavirus cases in Clark County. The upside to coronavirus is it's not nearly as contagious as measles. The downside is with measles, most people in the population are immunized. So with coronavirus, theoretically, we're all susceptible. But I'm hoping that some of these social distancing measures that have taken place, you know, quarantine and isolation will really help. But meanwhile, right now, in Clark County, the risk is really low and remote in terms of coronavirus. And Jonah's absolutely right. Right now, influenza is much more of a risk to the folks in Clark County than coronavirus is. I don't know if folks have any questions about that. I went on and on.
Wash your hands.
Yeah, well, so the other thing about, you know, like masking, if you were to wear a mask right now, it wouldn't do anything to protect you. The masks are to be used on people who are sick to keep them from, because you're going to get, you know, the coronavirus gets on people's hands and you touch, you know, you don't wash your hands, you shake somebody's hands, you touch them, you touch an object, somebody else touches it. You know, that's where the risk is. We do not recommend well people going around and wearing masks. There's mask shortages anyway. Sick people should be staying home, and, you know, if they have other people in their home, they should be wearing masks. Yes?
It's my understanding the masks that we have is not good for it anyway. There's much stronger masks that are almost like cover the complete face.
Yeah, well, the masks, the most effective masks are called N95, and they have to be really fit tested. But the reason for sick people wearing a mask is they're somewhat effective because they keep the secretions. There's nothing you can do, really. You wearing even an N95 mask. So, you know, the message to the hospital folks, they're not just doing respiratory precautions. They are wearing masks, but they're also wearing gloves and gowns. They're taking droplet. They're using standard precautions and droplet precautions. And they're wearing goggles in the hospital. So you don't want to spend your time running, you know, walking around the neighborhood and there'd be no reason to, wearing gloves, masks, goggles, you know, gowns, and all those other things. But yeah, that might help. That would help protect you. But I don't think that's. I think that's a bit overkill, and it's not sustainable anyway.
Well, I just saw that I was in India. Last week, and I was flying back from Singapore to San Francisco, and
probably 60% of the people in the airports and the planes were wearing masks.
Mm-hmm. And they weren't sick.
And they were not sick. At least they were not.
Yeah, they weren't coughing or
hacking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody have any other questions about novel coronavirus? We do need to be vigilant. I mean, this thing can get out of hand, and already is out of hand somewhat. And the other hope is as the weather changes, that might have some benefit also, because these bugs tend to circulate more during the cold times, and more people are inside in congregate settings. The state is in ICS, State Health Department is in incident command. We're not anywhere close to that, but we are discussing about what we might need to do if things got out of hand.
Next topic is the ethic committee update, and that's Roxanne and Dr. Mellick.
Did you want to?
Do you want me to go? Yeah, I can go ahead and do that. So, I'm going to make this really short. So, we have, and folks are welcome to join the Ethics Committee, by the way, but the most recent thing the Ethics Committee had done, actually been working on it for a few years, was, and I wish we had this done a year ago because of the last discussion we just had. But the Ethics Committee has actually finally adopted, all parties are supportive of this, a ventilator allocation scoring system. So if we have a pandemic, a respiratory pandemic, where the demand for ventilators exceeded the supply, the default option, and you've heard me say this before, would be first come, first serve for who gets a ventilator or not. And that doesn't make any sense. So the Ethics Committee had developed a scoring system for who gets a ventilator. And by the way, the same scoring system would be used to remove people from ventilators as well as putting them on when the demand exceeds supply. The scoring system is based on three scores. One score is called the sequential organ failure assessment, which is a measure of your likelihood, given the state of your organs, to make it out of the ICU in the first place. The second measure is based on the whether you have comorbidities like kidney disease, severe kidney disease, or emphysema, or conditions that would make you less likely to survive, this even with the ventilator. The Ethics Committee had tweaked it because we originally had mild to moderate comorbidities on there, and they felt like using those in the scoring system would increase disparities with for populations that were more at risk for things like diabetes, and it might increase disparities. So we're considering major and severe comorbidities. The last part of the scoring system originally was based on what was called the life cycle principle, and everybody should have the same the same opportunity to live every phase of life. And everybody should have the equal right to be a child, to be a teenager, to be an adult, to be an elderly person, and so on. It was basically a euphemism for age. One of our partners, and I think this made the whole process better, Peace Health, felt that it was discriminatory based on age. And the other two principles, the comorbidity principle and the SOFA score, were really based on prognosis, on your likelihood to survive. So Peace Health and the ethicist, Dr. Morrison, who's she's a vascular surgeon who went on, got her master's in ethics, and runs the bioethics committee at Peace Health, suggested that we could use age, but we could use, and Peace Health was supportive of this, age is a prognostic factor. So we took a look at the data in terms of respiratory illness, severe respiratory illness, and determined that your prognosis really gets worse, significantly worse, after 65. So we now have a scoring system that differentiates between people under 65 and over 65. And it really relates to prognosis, not just this opportunity to have different, be different, live different ages. So Peace Health is supportive of that. So now that we've got this all agreed to, our next step is actually to reach out to the leadership at Legacy Hospitals, Legacy Salmon Creek and Peace Health. Legacy approved the old version. I'm sure they're likely to approve the new version. Get them to agree on it. We'll need some agreements on this. And then we're going to develop a triage team, which is part of the plan, that will include a critical care doc, a critical care nurse, and an ethicist who will actually be making the decision. We don't want the provider at the bedside to make this decision because they obviously have a relationship with their patient. And the triage team will not know anything about the patient, will not know what their occupation is, will not know what their gender, race, ethnicity, nothing about them other than the score, and they will make the decision about who gets the ventilator or not. So, and once we have that plan all worked out and the agreements in place, it'll become part of our emergency plan that we can trigger when we have a situation where the demand exceeds the supply. So that's the first thing the ethics committee is working on. I don't know if anybody have any questions about that.
I just have one, and that is because if that situation occurred in Clark County, it's probably going to be occurring in many other places.
Yeah.
So are you publishing the findings that you're coming to and the process that you've gone through, and or is the state following this with some interest so that we don't end up with all the counties trying to figure this out when all this work has already been done?
We will disseminate this for sure.
And the state ethics committee is already aware of this, and we've been sharing that information. And so, yeah, that is important.
The Oregon folks have a guideline, but it has some basic values in it and talks about how things should be done, but it doesn't address the worst case scenario. So our proposal here just addresses the worst case scenario. So we had Dr. Lehman from the Oregon Health Division came and met with us. He's with their preparedness program, and he's fine with this, but they don't have a, I don't know whether they'll adopt this, but they don't have a worst case scenario plan where you're really dealing with a situation where there are not enough ventilators to go around.
Does this apply to private ventilators or facilities?
I'm sorry, what?
Does it apply to private people on ventilators?
No, and you know why it doesn't? So we originally considered, when we first did this a few years ago, we actually reached out in our ethics committee to find some folks from the ALS Association because we wanted all the stakeholders involved, including people on home ventilators. And we couldn't find somebody from ALS, but some of the home ventilator folks, the people provided. And the reason it doesn't apply to home ventilators is they cannot be used. They're not the type of ventilators that you can use in a hospital setting. So what we all agreed on is we would never take the home ventilator away from anybody who's on it at home. But if they were to get sick and ended up in the hospital and needed a hospital ventilator, they would be subjected to the same scoring system as everybody else. So, but you can, I learned a lot through this. You can't, home ventilators are not the type of ventilators that you can use in an ICU. They don't have that kind of functionality.
And the question I had maybe a year ago was, in this process of all this discernment that you've done, has there been any discussion about, are there biomedical breakthroughs that would allow a single person to serve more than one person if they were on very similar settings?
No. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
The answer is no.
I would find that, yeah.
No, you're going to cross-contaminate.
Yeah.
And there are multiple circuits. It's not physically capable.
You would if it was a rotating
circuit. And everybody
circuit.
Needs different pressures, and they have different size lungs.
I know that. I worked in an ICU.
So,
but
no,
it's things have changed.
Anyway, so now that discussion, but that would change the metrics if
right.
that were.
Yeah.
But right now we don't have that. But you're a critical care nurse, you may want to volunteer for the triage team. So.
We have fancy ventilators in Portland too.
We
have fancy ventilators in Portland too that look really basic but are powerhouses for the flu and things like that, and removing CO2 when you start to get really, really, really sick.
Yeah. So anyway, so we'll, so this system will be, hopefully we'll, hopefully we'll never have to use it. But you know, I'm thinking now that we have coronavirus, and actually, when we were discussing this a couple of years ago, one of, I think it was a nurse from PeaceHealth, had been in Texas, and they were in a situation, I think it was during the hurricanes, where they were in a small community where I think they did run out of ventilators. So it's not unheard of, this kind of thing happening. Okay. The ethics committee is looking at other issues to deliberate on, and given that the state may have some trouble figuring out this vaping legislation and the flavor ban, the meeting in April, the ethics committee looked at a variety of topics that they would want to address, and one of them is the restrictions on vape-related products. So so go ahead.
Can I just say, and then the other one that they're looking at right now too is in environmental health, looking at food safety processes for different types of food from different cultures and how it's processed and how it's provided in a restaurant setting. So that's another.
Yeah, I think the way I learned about this years ago is that there's some ethnic foods that do not meet the food code, but really are safe. I think when I heard, like, Peking duck was an interesting one because it's in a cabinet held at not the temperature that would not pass inspection, but the way it's prepared and use the use of vinegar and the things sewn together, that it may actually be safe. But our food code really doesn't address practices that have been going on for a long time and may be safe. So that may be the second one that people be. That's just an example. So it's all interesting. So ethics committee gets into some interesting discussions. So that's all I have on the ethics committee. Is there anything else?
I think the next thing is, if nothing else on ethics, then it would be Janet's report.
Yeah. So I'll have more for you after the short session. But I asked Travis to give you a little update. There's a bill that I thought maybe of interest to everybody around a statewide plastic bag single-use ban. Do you want
to? Yeah. So I introduced myself before. I'm the solid waste program manager here at Alcohol. So you probably not going to go to my advisory council. So if anybody wants to go to a garbage specific advisory council, I was looking for people as well. Am I allowed to coach? So there is this is the second run at a statewide plastic bag bin. The gist is that this essentially bans what they're calling t-shirt plastic bags at grocery stores, so the typical grocery bag you would get out at checkout. Instead, you would have the option of if you bring your own, but they're implementing an 8-cent fee on if you take any type of disposable bag of paper, or they're going to be selling what they deem more reusable as a thicker plastic bag. So what you see like the Nike employee store, or I mean, we know a thick plastic would be less. It's a thicker plastic bag. The retailers would charge an 8-cent fee for each bag, with the incentive that you pay 8 cents for it, you would want to reuse it again. Other bags, newspaper bags, dry cleaning, produce bags, prescription drugs are exempt, as well as all the WIC. And it does set some color standards on compostable bags, which is kind of a big deal in a lot of food programs. Compostable bags would be green or brown consistently, and non-compostable bags would not be green or brown. So. Just to set those. So, I mean, that's the gist. It seems to have there seems to be a lot of confidence that it's going to do well. It made quite a bit of movement last year, and so I think there's already 37 municipalities in the state that have a plastic bag ban. So, this be looking at just expanding what already exists. But it did get quite a bit of resistance last year towards the very end. So, but it seems to be moving right now.
Many of the many of the stores that are in the Portland area are not charging for paper bags. You know, various prices. I don't know how that's that comes about, but you know, Safeway, if it's a large paper bag, it's like the 12 cents at a liquor store, it's 5 cents for this bag, or you know, not sure how they come at it, but everybody's charging for paper bags.
I guess I didn't realize there was such a wide variety, but I've seen the nickel was pretty much a consistent one. But I didn't realize there was a difference in what they were charging for different bags places. So it does.
I just heard about the liquor store.
Oh, okay. I'll have to stop the one on my way on the back. I'll double check for me. Yeah, I'll do some research.
We should know by the next meeting.
Yes, the final thing, right?
Was that everything for you,
Jim? Yes. Okay, thank you. Yes. The Community Health Award. Yes, so as you may recall, last year we postponed the Community Health Award because we were really thinking of responding to the measles outbreak. So we've got it back on the agenda for this year. This is usually an annual award. And what it is we've done a news release, we disseminate it throughout the community. We've got two types of, we can nominate an organization or an individual for a Community Health Award. And once these awards, once the nominations come through, there's a nomination committee that, or a review committee that takes a look at vetting. And everyone who is nominated gets recognized, but there's one Community Health Award that's actually given with a plaque for an individual member and an organization. So you're welcome to, there's some forms on the desk when you leave if you don't already have one. If you have anyone in mind that you'd like to nominate, please do. This is also on our website. We also had a news release that was recently in the Columbian and I think other places as well. The nominations are due into the public health by February 28th. If any of you on FAC would be interested in participating in the review committee, if you could just, Doreen, if you wouldn't mind, can I have them, if you could quick email Doreen and let her know, we'll be putting together, the committee will be not just public health employees, but also members of the community, so you're welcome to join. Or if you have anyone else that you think would like to join the committee, you can please let us know. Once the nominations are set and the awardees are designated, they will be presented at the Board of Health meeting in April. It's before the Board of Health meeting. The council, Board of Health counselors actually hand the awards out. Members of the community will be there, those some refreshments and that sort of thing right before the Board of Health meeting. So that's the first week, right? First or second week of, I think it's the first week of April is when that's going to happen.
Okay, in April,
right? Any questions? Okay, thank you.
So next is council member update. Any members of the council wish to share? Thank you. Did you hear me?
No, I put my mask back on my nose.
Oh, okay. Then I won't call you for that. Joan,
Recently I had my UT students go to the harm reduction center and get the harm reduction training and get the Narcan. And I think it would be great because, you know, we are really trying to get every person in the community. And I think it would be great if we could maybe have Randy come and do that presentation here and make sure members of the council understand and how easy it is to have Narcan available. You know, if you have somebody in your own family, but as well as if you find somebody that's down, it's a drug that doesn't hurt anybody. It just reverses the use of opioids if in fact the person is out because of opioid abuse. But I think it would be really informative to have maybe ask Randy to come and do a training at the beginning of one of the meetings and show if the training is about a half an hour and then issue the Narcan to the person.
That would be interesting. Thank you. Other updates?
I just want to update. I'm on the Heritage Farm Advisory Committee, and many of you have probably been reading about the issues around Heritage Farm and the addressing the master plan update, and I was just at the Parks Advisory Board tonight trying to get support for that. And so it's really a place where it really does affect the health of the community because of the work that's done there and growing food and all the healthy organizations and work that's done there. So I just wanted to bring that up, and if you have any ways of wanting to support the master plan, there's also going to be some strategic planning. I think there's a work session on February 19th to address it. We're fairly certain that the councils are going to go ahead and okay the master plan, probably not at that work session, but shortly thereafter. But one of the things they'll be calling for is looking at for more ideas of how to better utilize that farm. It's utilized quite well already, and that's the work that I've been doing is summarizing how many volunteers. And there's nearly $1 million of volunteer time and money and grants and in-kind that goes into that farm outside of the funding that the county gives the Heritage Farm. And that's not well known, that there's that much money that goes into supporting the work that's there and producing food and helping people learn how to be healthy and eat healthy and be active and the juvenile justice work and so on and so forth. So, but they're going to be looking at ways that we can increase activities and events that happen on the farm, or what are some other kinds of things that we can do, like people say a farmer's market, and that's kind of iffy whether that would work or not, but an incubator kitchen project or an incubator farm project, or how can we support agriculture in our community and support more local food access to help the community health. So there's going to be some things come out, I think, out of that asking for community input, and so I can keep you posted when some of those things will be happening, but that's going to be coming down the line in the next year to come. There's going to be a community conversation that the Food System Council is going to be holding on February 27th. I had to give all my forms to the Park Advisory Group that I was going to bring here. But it's February 27th from 6 to 8. It will be held at the museum. And Justin O'Day, who does the research for WSU Extension on the farm, is going to talk about agriculture and food production in the Willamette Valley compared to here in Clark County, and how the soils and the ag systems are very similar, but the value of agriculture in the Willamette Valley is 2 to 4 times more valuable than it is in here in Clark County. And why is that? And why can't it be as valuable here? And then there'll be someone here from the incubator kitchen or incubator farm project that's held out in Gresham, and we're going to try to look at how we might be able to replicate something similar to that at the Heritage Farm. So they're going to come and talk about their project, and then a local farmer will be there to talk about the impact of the Heritage Farm on their farming practices and what WSU Extension has done. So that's a community conversation on February 27th if anybody's interested in that kind of a topic. So I just wanted to bring it to this group because I think it's a place where there's lots of activity that can go on that affects the health of the community and projects that go on there. So.
Well, thank you.
Sandy, would it help if the FAC was interested, or if there was enough support, to send a letter to the council in support of this?
Yeah, there were two councilors there tonight at the Parks Advisory, and Parks Advisory asked if a letter of support from them would be important, and they said yes, they would love to hear support from other community groups that are support continue. There's been a lot of rumors that they're going to sell the farm and that they're going to do other kinds of things, and they're kind of supposed to those ideas, but they're really looking at how can we enhance it, can it be self-sustaining, how is it managed, how can we do more on that property, because there's lots of opportunity there. Mm-hmm. And so pushing to support the master plan and support a strategic plan for how we can increase things that go on there that help support the health of the community.
You know, it goes back to when we, you know, when this group, in the Growing Healthier report, and we were talking about, Paul remembers this, the food that you know, we were very supportive of the work that was going on in our community about agriculture, and that's what the farm is all about. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's consistent with what we've been working on here on the FAC for many years. And if the rest of the council would agree, I think we should send a letter supporting the strategic planning and the ideas that you just talked about at the Heritage Farm.
And we're trying to tell the councilors that, you know, the investment that they have in that, the multiplier effect of, you know, there's over 1,500 volunteers that come there. There's over 2,500 people that come and participate, including 1,300 youth that come to that farm and learn about how food production happens and how local food is, and all of the things that go along with that. And that's, there's a multiplier effect that all of those people then go home and talk to their family members or their friends. And so if you say 2 to 3 people, each one talk to two or three people there, you've reached a large number, and it could be bigger if there was more going on there. So we kind of want to support the growth of what goes on up there. So we think it was negative that this whole issue came about, but it's really turning into a positive, that it is really bringing the community around the farm, and how can that really enhance the health of the community by what goes on at that farm.
I wonder if, Joan, would you be willing to make a motion?
Yeah, I'd like to move that the FAC send a letter of support for what Sandra talked about at the Heritage Farm.
And a second.
Thank you. Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sandy, you gotta help write the letter.
It's more to ask the committee for information for us. There is this nasty rumor, it may have already happened, the Navigation Center, which is a great resource for the homeless out there, is closing. So who has the latest information on that?
Okay. So,
what's going to happen with it?
Okay. I don't know what's going to happen with it per se. It's not closing. The city of Vancouver have actually taken that back over again. Mm-hmm. It was being managed by the Share House.
They stepped out of it on January 31st, and the city has an RFP out for a new operator, and there are like three or four people that have toured, and the deadline isn't until like February 21st or something like that. So the city is seeking another operator.
Yeah. But the deadline's February 21st.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If they don't find anybody, it's going to close.
I think they're going to find an operator. I mean, I think, you know, if you follow it in the paper, there have been different, they've had tour people. If they're going to apply, they have to go and do a tour. And the city's invested too much to close that.
Yeah, it's a great resource for the homeless. I mean, it gives them a place to spend the day, you know, shower up, do their laundry, drop their stuff off so they're secure. The free clinic goes there. That's why I'm involved with it. We were kind of wondering what was going to happen to the whole thing.
So right now, Parks and Rec is the operator, mm-hmm. and that's just an interim. You know, they're very good at center operations. They're not, their forte is not social services, but they're doing that right now until a new operator is selected. So they're holding the fort down. So.
Yeah, I don't want to see that safety net close. So.
Thank you for bringing that up. I didn't know that. Any other comments?
I just wanted to remind you that our very own chief, Bob Richardson, is retiring, as you all know. And his retirement party, I guess it's a party, his retirement event is tomorrow afternoon. We sent you all that notification. So if any of you all are available and wanting to go, it starts, I think, at about 4 o'clock and from 4 to 6 at the Battleground Community Center on Main Street in Battleground. So you're all welcome to go. I think there's like an open house from 4 to 5, and then there's going to be a formal kind of a presentation for him between 5 and 6.
Thank you for that.
All right, thank you.
And I'll put out the last call for any final words, comments. Hearing none, we will be adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.